Accession number 19766, Reel 7.
That's Griffiths, Reel 7.
Well, now, let's think. Where were we? Down in the river. In the Manipur River. That was the name of the river I was trying to think of earlier on, the Manipur. Anyway, we had to cross the Manipur, which wasn't in flood yet. The monsoon just hadn't started. That was to come. And we crossed the river, and we were on the main road, and we got off the main, off the Imphal road, because we were about 150 miles from Imphal. They used to talk of the Chindits being inside Burma. We'd been inside Burma long before the Chindits ever came there on Kennedy Peak. So we got off the main road and we travelled through elephant grass, which was about this high, slowly moving our way through, and every now and then having a fright of our lives because there would be shots fired or something would go off and there'd be a skirmish somewhere and somebody would get wounded and that sort of thing. This happened. And we had a battle, and I've forgotten the name of the place now, but we lost about eight men. It was a bad, very bad do for us to lose at one time there. We lost odd men before, but not a lot of men like that. And wounded, and it was a very, very bad do. And I've forgotten the names of these places, but... So we came on, we got out of that, we came through the elephant grass, and I remember I was alongside the CO's signaller. Can't remember his name. I can see him so clearly. He was alongside me. He was a singer. Ralph Meller. Ralph, a marvellous singer. He used to write the news that quickly, write in freehand. And I don't know anything about signalling and all that sort of thing. And I say, how the heck can he write that fast? And read it out to me afterwards, or read out to anybody. Marvellous. So Ralph and I were fairly close together when along came, over the head came a shower of mortar bombs. And we all dived. And Ralph and I dived behind a tree about as thick as that thing there. And we were scrabbling down, just getting as low as we could. And I felt a burning sensation on my upper arm, this arm, yeah. Oh, I thought I'd been hit. And in my mind, I had a dangling arm. It wouldn't be long now. It would be gone. And I said to Ralph, I've been hit up here somewhere. Can you have a look? So he moved a little, get closer to me. And he did that and he flicked out a bit of red hot metal. That's all it was. It was in my sleeve. We had nothing on underneath the jacket, you see. So it was just a single bit of cloth. And it was moving about, you see. Every time I moved, it moved. And it burnt my arm. Didn't do me any real harm, except that it made me jump every time I did it. And that's all it was. But the visions I had, of course, was that I'd be walking out of there with one arm. So I told Ralph about that many times, but he died last year, I think. Ralph did. He's from up north. Most of the lads were from the north anyway. Right across. And then what happened after that? By which time we were getting hungry, and really hungry, because we had no food. So we come down onto the main road. And I remember, because we were a bit cunning, most of us had a little streak of cunning in us, you know. And I had stashed away somewhere in one of my pockets, a little sachet of milk. Was it milk? I'm getting mixed up here. It was either milk or sugar or something, chini or milk or sugar. And I had one of those stashed away, and somebody else had something else stashed away, and somebody else had something else stashed away. So we got behind some hidey hole in a hidey hole and lit a little bamboo fire. So somebody said, "Who's got the tea?" So he had a little sachet of tea. "Who's got the milk?" I said, "I got the milk." "Who's got the sheeny, the sugar?" "I've got the sugar, right, right." So we made this drop of tea in a Dixie. In went the tea, in went the sugar, and in went my milk. And it's the most awful cup of tea I've ever tasted, because it wasn't milk, it was soup. Bouillon soup. I think that's pretty oniony, if I remember rightly. It was awful. But these things happen. So there we were, stuck on the edge of the Imphal Road, a long way from Imphal, and up the valley we could see what looked like a mosquito coming, and it was a little aeroplane. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger. He must have had a message from somewhere, the pilot, because he came down on the road. He landed on the road in a little aeroplane, and he was about a 6-foot American came out of it, big tall fella. And he looked round for the COOs over there. And I always remember this. People might say this is not true, but this is absolutely true. They couldn't give him anything as a, you know, sort of thing. "We want a drink? We haven't got any." All he had, all the CO and the company had at that particular moment was beetroot, for some reason or another. So they had a chinwag, he and the CO. They had a chinwag about this, that and the other. He got back in his plane, turned it around, and shot back off. And he came up 2 or 3 hours later with American Russians. Now, they had a name for them. I've forgotten the name. The American Russians. They were all in boxes.
K-Russians.
Those are them. They were all in boxes. I can tell you, you've had a lot of interviews, haven't you? Yeah, K-Russians. And we all had a box each. But some of the stuff in them was terrible, really. It all smelt or chewed like chewing gum. Wrigley's. But it was better than nothing. We thought they were like Christmas puddings. So anyway, we all had these boxes of K rations, and that kept us going for quite a while, really, because sweets as well in there, a little bit of everything. Anyway, we moved on from there, and instead of us hoping that we were going to stay on the road, at least it was flat, we turned sharp left, and we all started to say among ourselves, "Up the borders, up the cuds," because we're either going up a mountain or down a mountain, because the Chin Hills are not really hills, they're mountains. And they can be very, very high and steep in particular. So here we were, once again, off the road, climbing. I don't know where we got, who had the map or maps. It must be somebody up there, because we never... And then we came to a spot where we suddenly dropped down. And we were at a place which was mapped, and it was known by its milestone, like 107 or something. I can't remember which milestone. But there was a camp there. And it was run by an Indian, or Indians, if you like. And it was a staging camp where stuff were brought and then taken up, farther up towards us, in other words, Kennedy. But when we got into this camp very gingerly and carefully, what Japs were in there, and then we knew there were Japs in there, they scattered, because there were more of us than there was of them. They scarpered. And we got into this camp, and it was full of all sorts of things. It was full of food, and boots, and Christmas puddings. And you can imagine what the boys did with the Christmas puddings and tins of milk. We were sick as dogs, all of us. And things full of lemonades and all that sort of thing. And I remember somebody saying to me, "What the hell are Christmas puddings doing in here 3 months after Christmas?" You know, we were annoyed, and oh, we were in a temper. But, of course, the boys just ate what they could and were as sick as dogs. We all were. And into the camp came an Indian officer from somewhere. And I was with my my boss. My boss was now the colonel, because the previous colonel had been he'd left the camp. He'd left. Colonel Verby, he'd left. Under a cloak. So my officer took over. Spedding, Colonel Spedding he became. And this Indian officer came up to this main little basher, which was obviously the office, and said something to Colonel Spedding, and Colonel Spedding said, "Who are?" I remember because I was there with my I was a Tommy gun. I had a Tommy gun. He said to the officer, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm lieutenant or captain, somebody or other, in charge of the camp. Are you? Well, where have you been till now?" "Up in the hills." "Well, back up the hills." He sent him out of the camp. Never saw him after that. He scarpered, because he had scarpered, and he was, as far as the colonel was concerned, he disgraced himself. You know, he'd run. He'd run, in other words. And according to his ethics, he shouldn't have done that. Anyway, we never saw him again. So we ate and we drank. Not alcohol. Never found any alcohol. There was nothing to worry in that sense, as far as I can recollect. But to get from there, we had to climb up again. Climb out. And then everybody was sick as dogs with all they'd eaten. Christmas puddings, biscuits, everything. Oh, it was, there was everything there. Anyway, we eventually got out of there. And we sort of had little skirmishes here and little skirmishes there. Odd chaps were wounded and killed and missing. And we climbed another stiff mountain peak. We climbed and climbed, and we were on our last legs getting to the summit. And when we got to the summit, there were some Indian sepoys up there. And they had cans of sort of big tins full of water. And as we got over the top, they threw the water at us. The most beautiful moment. The water hole.
They're trying to water hole, you say?
Yes. And they'd seen us coming up in a terrible state we were. And as soon as we got to the summit of this cud, they threw this water. They didn't offer it to us to drink. They just threw water at us because they knew the state we were in. It is out of this world, we thought. But then we got to a village up the Cuds somewhere. There was nothing in it. Empty old bashes on poles. There were the poles with the palm roofs, you know. So we sorted ourselves various bashes, and that's where we were going to stay and for a while, and patrol from there. So the patrols were set out in various places, and we were there, I think, for 6 weeks, and we were in a terrible state. We had, and this is no exaggeration, we had 2 ounces of cheese for breakfast, 2 ounces of sardines in the middle of the day, and 2 ounces of cheese for the next meal, and that went on for about 6 weeks. And every now and then, of course, somebody had to go for water somewhere or another. Water was always found somewhere in those places. And tea. And chaps were walking around, which was unusual, with beards, because we had no means of shaving. And that was pretty bad. Particularly for a strict charge hand in the colonel. He was strictly strict. And chaps stopped saluting. And that was regarded. He wouldn't have that. He said that you must continue to salute. Otherwise, you know, there'll be trouble. So we made what they call punjis. A punji is a long bamboo stick with a point at both ends, about 4 feet long, if you could find the right sort of bamboo. And you plunge it into the ground in front of your trench with one point, and the other point, of course, was to hook anybody who got near to you, hopefully. They were called punjis. And if anybody in that particular 6 weeks that we were there got out of hand in any way, his penalty was to get himself another 12 punches. You know, you another 12 punches for that. You shouldn't do that sort of thing. Sounds a bit childish, but it's quite serious stuff. So we were there for about 6 weeks, I think, and we were getting weaker and weaker and weaker through lack of food. And then I don't know whether messages came or what, because you don't know what goes... We didn't know what went through the air, of course, to the colonels. We were going to leave on this Friday night, tomorrow night or the night after, whatever it was. And the monsoons had started, and it was... We were lying in water all the time. And I'm not exaggerating, we were actually lying in water all the time, the monsoons. The early monsoons had finished and the real monsoons had started. There are two lots of monsoons. There's the early one.
What's it called?
There's a name for it, I've forgotten now. The early one, which isn't too bad, and then it starts. And we left on this night. We always had capes, by the way, canvas capes. We put our capes on, you were soaking wet with sweat anyway, because it's hot as well. So, and we left this camp all quiet, no fires, and we sidled out of the camp, so to speak, and down the Cuds. And prior to this, I had toothache. I had an awful pain coming from my tooth back here. And I said to the colonel one day, I said, I've got toothache because I'm in some awful, because I was doing something. He said, well, go and see McConaughey, see what he can do for you. McConaughey's tools were like engineer's tools. You know, some of them were, he looked at me and he said, and just for a joke, he held a spanner in his hand and he says, just come here and I'll fix it for you. I said, not on you and Ellie. So, it was decided that it was bad, there's no doubt about that. Well, if you can find your way to Imphal, which was over there, down there somewhere, but the road was clear from Imphal to the road, which was 2 or 3 miles down there somewhere, you can go to Imphal. There was always somebody or other. There were always patrols out, you see. So I went out with the patrol one morning, got down to the road, to the Imphal road eventually, and walked along the Imphal road till a lorry came along and got a lift into Imphal. Oh, that sounds, to me, it sounds a bit daft. But the trouble was up there, you see, not down here. The trouble at that, I was up on the Cuds. So I got this lift into Imphal where I reported to the centre, or this tent which had a medical, a dental place as well. This was after I'd been there. No, that was the first day I was there. Of course, I had to go. I had to find it. So I was sitting in the chair there, and he pulled my mouth open, and he looked at my teeth. He said something about my teeth. Your teeth are all right. He said, ah, what have we got here then? And right at the back here, between the wisdom tooth and the one this side of the wisdom tooth, I've still got all my teeth bar four, by the way. All these are mine. And he pulled out a piece of stone. Not a big, obviously, but... Trapped in your mouth, it's quite big. A piece of stone about as big as that, which had been jammed between these two teeth. And I could never feel that. I could never sort of say, I'll get you out. I didn't even know it was there until he took this out. And he got his tools out, whatever it was, a pair of little tweezers or something, and he yanked it out. I've never had toothache ever since. So that was easy. It sounds like a joke now, but it was true at the time. So I then had to report to what they called a cat box. There were areas allocated to certain divisions and to certain battalions. So mine was cat box. I had to report to cat box, which was up there somewhere. So I reported to cat box, where I had a kip for a couple of nights. And then there were reinforcements that come in from home. But there was nobody to take them up. And some of them were, including two officers, one was called Gay, I know I've forgotten the other's name, but I was the bloke who'd just come from there, so I was the leader of the pack. So I took them all the way back the way I had come. We went along the road so far in a lorry, and then we spread out on this open countryside, which was open there before the jungle started, and I was able to get them back to the battalion. Now, that happened before the night on which we left. So the night we left, everything was quiet. All the companies had gathered together, all the platoons had gathered together, and we were a long line of a few hundred. We were probably 600-700 men altogether. It's a long line. All in the middle of the night, and we moved out of this camp, and we moved down the Cuds alongside the trees. The way I'd gone with this tooth business, because he said to me, he said, there's a bit of trouble up there. They're not sure which way to go. Well, I was the bloke who happened to know which way to go. So I went forward and I was in the front and I knew which way to go. And eventually we came down to the road. Nothing special about it. Just happened that I knew that particular way. And it was throwing it down. And the clouds were sort of tree high, you know. And here we were, stood on the Imphal Road, looking around, and all you could see, the Imphal Road now is level with the paddy fields, the rice fields, and all you could see was water. A tree over there, three or four trees over there, another one over there, nothing but water. And we wondered what the heck we're going to do next, you know. And so we stood on the side of the road there, stretched out along this road, and then word came from somewhere, as it always does, and the CO pointed out to his officers their areas, and all their areas were in that sea of water. And we know-alls, of course, we all looked at one another and said, what, in there? You can't go in there. And there was a foot of water for miles and miles and miles as far as you could see, because a paddy field is made up of small squares surrounded by what they call bunds, clay walls, in other words. When they empty the beds, they just cut a chunk out of the wall and the water runs away. So all these were full of water, and that was going to be our next stop, and it was our next stop. We just walked across the road, walked into the water, and A Company over there, B Company up there, and so on. HQ will be here, and so on. And we used to look around. What the hell are we going to do here? Just water, nothing else but water. Come on, you lads, says one of the two of the officers who had to be what they were. They were paid to be officers, and that's all there is. You can do better than that, or words to that effect, you know. And behold, and it wasn't long before, instead of being slopping about in water, we were slopping about in mud, because we let the water out. And we found the main channel where it eventually ended, went to, and opened that out. And we just slopped in mud as long as we were there. We got they brought us pieces of canvas, which we could put on sticks over our heads. And I can't remember how long we were there for, but it wasn't very long, but it was long enough to have a new experience, put it that way. And it was awful, really. It was mud, mud, mud. And we used to think, I wonder what the officers are doing now. They're probably sitting in a bash or somewhere, having a chota peg, or whatever they used to call it. But, of course, we always said those things about the officers. Some of them were worse off than we were. But now, from there, eventually, we moved out of there. I can't think where we moved to, unless it was to Pots and Pans, or Pots and Balm is the proper name. Pots and Pans, we used to call it, where we had a real battle. I can't remember which came first, because we had two big battles, and we lost an awful lot of men, and killed and wounded.
Yes, you were telling me that there were really two battles. There was this battle in the monsoon in which you lost so many men. And then you said after the monsoon, there was a Pots and Pans battle.
Well, the Pots and Pans battle, for that, the division brought up as many guns as they could. And it was the battle where most where more guns were used than in any other battle, I believe, in the Burma campaign, perhaps other than the 1945 campaign, which came later, of course. But we knew that behind us we had rows of guns which fired over our heads, and we used to hope that they continued to go over our heads, being what we were, way up in the front somewhere. But overnight we lay doggo in the jungle on the edge of the paddy, which led us to Pots and Pans. Pots and Pans was just a village in a jungle, in a small piece of jungle. And as dawn broke, just at dawn, the air was thick with mist. It was like a veil everywhere. And we were all tapped on the shoulder, come on, up you get, by the sergeants, people like that. And then once we got up on our feet, we were then told to move forward. And we moved through the one line, at least, of gunners who were there. Because one gunner turned to come up to me as I was walking past. And he said, he must have known my name or something, or knew who I was. He said, "Good luck, Taffy," or something like that. Or I heard my voice. "Best of luck, Taff," or "Good luck, Taff," something like that. So we moved on to the flat of the paddy fields, and lined up, and we were in this heavy, very, very heavy, thick dawn mist, so nobody could see us from any distance. And alongside me was all our own chaps, of course, and farther along the line would be the Gurkhas, and farther along the other side would be another lot of soldiers. So we were on a very, very long line, which on the signal would advance. And we got the signal. Everybody looked at their watches, which had all been primed for to get the right time, and we started to walk. And when I say walk, that's all we did, was just stroll on as if we were going to a park with a dog, you know, just a stroll. So we strolled on, and we'd strolled on for quite a while before the gun started. And then his big guns up in the cuds, hidden among the jungle, where he had much bigger guns than we had, because he used to haul them up there with elephants, the Japs. And their shells used to come down, and they did a lot of damage. And we had a few chaps killed there. And one chap fell alongside me. I was alongside the colonel. And the colonel said to me, "You better stay with him. Stay with him, Griffiths," he said, "and until somebody can come up and pick him up." I can see the chap now, and I can't for the life of me ever remember his name. I remember what they called him, but I won't mention that because it wasn't very complimentary. But he was wounded. He had shrapnel bits all over him, and he was shouting and sort of yelling a bit. He was laying down and yelling, so I just slapped his face, which is what I must have seen in a film or somewhere, which you do in those circumstances. And he did stop yelling. But he was badly hurt, obviously. And I stayed there with him while the battalion and all the troops who were in this battle were moving forward. And I felt very lonely, believe me. Because it was just he and I together against the world, so to speak. And eventually the stretcher bearers came up and took him away. And then I realized.